plan is to do House bills until 2 o'clock, give or take a few minutes. And if we get through them, then we will, and if we don't, we don't. At 2 o'clock, then, we will start the public hearing on Senate Bill 922, 408, and 572. So we're going to do House bills the first part of this. And we're going to public hearing on House Bill 2604. And, members, when we were last dealing with this bill, this is the real estate bill, we got down to a couple of key issues in terms of the substance of the bill regarding the advertising standard and the negligence standard. There was also some discussion, extensive discussion in committee about the process for the Senate discussion of this bill compared to what happened in the House. And so I did go back, just to let you know, I went back and reviewed the tapes of the House committee hearing. And in the original public hearing, there was discussion of the negligence standard in the work session. They didn't talk about that issue. They talked about other issues, and that was not brought up as an objection at that particular meeting. So that's what I discovered from listening to it. But having said that, the real issue is whether this is a good policy choice, and so we're going to explore that. The first part here, I've also asked Legislative Council, who will be returning here, I asked them to give me an independent attorney's view of that issue, because we've had warring attorneys on that. But before that, I have the old sign-up list from the first hearing for those who did not speak, and I can't quite read the name, so I apologize, but it looks like Tim Fow and Emily Cedarleaf, who had signed up previously. So if you two would come up forward, we'd be pleased to have you address the committee. And Emily, you were higher on the list, so I'll let you start.
I appreciate that. Chairmaster and members of the committee, I'm Emily Cedarleaf, and I'm the Executive Director of the Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon. We are a trade association that serves property managers who include real estate licensees as well as the owners of rental property. I've been on the job for 30 years and been involved in the real estate agency's activities since 1981. Have gone through three commissioners and four regulatory managers. I also provide to members a service of consulting when the agency contacts them about a license violation or they want general knowledge, I go in and go through their files and assist them not in trying to get off with something, but how to do it better, how to do it correctly, and how not to cause their owners to lose money, because ultimately that's the consumer. At the time of the House side, I apologize. I have a health problem that I need to put my ego in my pocket and go buy a wheelchair and get around this building, but I was having massive health problems and did not get to testify. I did try in all methods to get into the work group, but was excluded from that. My concern with this bill boils down to Section 3. The questions that you asked the other day about the advertising, for real estate people who sell and list property, advertising is not an issue as great it is for property managers. Real estate licensees that list property see the property. For those that manage property, often they're putting a sign or an ad in. And I'll give you one example of an owner that called me from Bend and said, I'm having horrendous amounts of attorney's fees. I don't understand why. And when I got into the thing, they kept advertising the property as Mountain View Apartments. They had one unit set up to view the mountain, no other unit except one on the third floor. If you stood on the toilet, looked out the tiny corner of the bathroom window, could you see the mountain? People would move in thinking they were going to get the unit with a mountain view, finding out they didn't. So then they'd move out, then they'd sue, then the attorney's fees would go against the owner. Happens numerous times on the coast. In 60 consulting things, I went through my files last night and found 9 in which, and I spent most of the 9 with attorneys on the phone trying to understand the gross negligence, and it boiled down to what is in the intent of the maker at the time. Of those files, most of them had to do with monies that were taken by licensees that were not authorized on a management contract or that they had charged against an owner. Ultimately, none of those monies were authorized. That means the owner was harmed, and the tenants then, or the property owners, had to raise the rent, so the next tenant had to have more money to pay for affordable housing. The issue on it is that Section 3 has not been thoroughly discussed with the property management side of the equation. There is 50 different ways of viewing gross negligence and negligence, but I will tell you from the property management side, the consumer side, and the owners that have to deal with real estate licensee managing their property, they believe they're protected. And with the change in this language, I don't believe so, as well as five attorneys that I've worked with. I've gone through the files. My bottom line is this will be bad for consumers. It will be bad for a choice of affordable housing. And the rest of the bill, I have no problem. Section 3 is a big issue for me in that gross negligence, negligence standard. I don't know if you'll ever arrive at a satisfactory answer. But the question is, what's it going to do to the consumer and the choice of affordable housing in the end? Property managers have millions of dollars that go through their hands in a year. Where a real estate licensee may get an earnest money, they put it into an escrow account. They don't deal with the money. My side of the equation deals with the money, and I'm telling you that's where the loss is going to be when the real estate standard can't hold them to that high, to that standard of negligence. Then we push them into court, and we have another bill on the other side that OAHR has introduced that will require them a person before they can file a lawsuit to find another licensee that will testify. These people aren't going to go to court. And so bottom line, housing costs will suffer because of that kind of activity. It's not that I'm against licensees. I work with them every day. What I'm wanting to do is protect the loss or possible loss of affordable housing because of the costs that will be involved.
Thank you. I think before we go questions, we'll... Tim, go ahead, please.
Chairman Metzger and members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, and I'm going to be very brief. I've given my written testimony to your administrator, and I'm just going to summarize a couple of major points in it. In the interest of you being able to move your brutal schedule today. I work for Oregon AFSCME Council 75, and I represent the classified employees at real estate. They have a very strong opinion that under the statute 696.015, the purpose of the agency is to assist in creating for the public a healthy real estate market atmosphere and to assure that professional real estate activity is conducted with high fiduciary standards. Under that purpose, they oppose the bill. They believe it unwise to eliminate limits to what fiduciary standards may be investigated. The bill appears to be a reaction on the part of OAR to what they see as arrogant and unfair investigations by REA and its investigators. It was dropped quickly without notice to a lot of other parties. Ms. Cedarleaf touched on it. But there are other parties here who haven't been heard from. There are licensees who are not represented by OAR. There are title and escrow companies, property management firms, consumer rights advocates. And in our conversations with some of them, they indicate that this bill came under the radar for them. We tried to testify in the House committee. By the time I was called, there were so many angry people on that committee, I was not allowed to testify and get my points. Instead, what I did was answer charges of misconduct on the part of the agency, which is not my role, but I tried. Then we had a work group, and Representative Kitts did a nice job with that, but the work group consisted of OAR and REA. I was allowed in the room primarily as an observer. But it was made clear to me that in Representative Kitts' view, I did not have an active participant role in that process. Nevertheless, they did really excellent work in that. When this bill was originally dropped, there were dozens of points that we objected to and that the agency objected to. Through a series of a couple of very difficult meetings, the sausage of law got made. Progress was made. People were able to compromise to where they could move towards their common goal, which is accountable and professional actions on the part of licensees. But one word stopped that from moving forward, and it was the difference between gross negligence and negligence. Now, for the record, because there's been testimony otherwise, we never agreed to the bill in the form that's in front of you. And for the record, neither did the agency in any time we were in the room. Now, that's not definitive, but it does tell you what we heard. Now, why are we against it on that one word? It comes down to negligence versus gross negligence for the threshold of investigation, and the implications are significant as they operate in the field. The standard of negligence is simple to establish. If there's incomplete, unsigned, undated, or undelivered documents, they violate the statute. They can raise questions that lead to a more thorough investigation of licensees' records. In almost all of those investigations, no other or no major offense is found. It was just careless error. But proof of major misconduct is never marked in big red letters with the words criminal activity. It's discovered through a careful audit and correlation of a mass of documents and testimony. Negligence should lead to that review. It is beyond us why negligence should be an acceptable practice. Gross negligence precludes investigation of clever, serious offenders. It also, coincidentally, prevents education and correction of sloppy practitioners. If you tie the hands on the front end, you control the product on the back end. Now, there have been improvements in the industry. OAR and Mr. Farmer testified to them, and they're real. But there are still serious infractions. In recent months, as a result, in part or whole, of REA investigations, licensees have been charged and prosecuted in Deschutes, Grant, and Yamhill counties. In Yamhill County, hundreds of vulnerable people were victimized by a criminal conspiracy of licensees and others. Now, I've got press reports on that attached. Public good requires zealous enforcement. I want to close with one more statement that I hope isn't contradictory. My members are sympathetic to OAR's concerns. Investigations are miserable experiences at best. As a union, we represent people who are charged all the time. And the fear that OAR refers to is real, especially in innocent people. And they and we also share the ground that our livelihoods rest on the outcomes. But that concern hasn't led us to advocate for limits on the employer's right and duty to investigate charges of misconduct. And that concern should not lead the state of Oregon to limit the state's duties with licensees. In a fair process, justice can be done, usually. We don't think the problems are statutory. We think they're structural. Presently, there's a really unhealthy lack of separation between the roles of the commissioner in overseeing the investigation process, presenting the case, and then ensuring that he makes a fair, reasonable determination on the complaint. It mixes the role of investigator, prosecutor, and judge, and in this particular case, without any meaningful appeal. Even when it's done right, it leaves wounded feelings and behind. It should be solved. But it can be solved other than a hasty, ill-advised rewrite of a statute that's been 87 years in the building. This statute is built on consumer protection reactions by the state of Oregon to past outrages. And we would really call for a more thorough review before any changes like this are approved. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, thank you.
Are you going to have legislative counsel?
Yes, I am. Thank you. I'd like Troy Costales to come forward. Troy comes forward as a citizen, and then I'm going to ask legislative counsel to come forward, and we're going to try to solve this issue here. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, and I am here as a citizen. Typically, you've seen me at this table representing the Oregon Department of Transportation. This is citizen testimony. I am a governor-appointed member of the Real Estate Board as a citizen on my own time, and when there are things during the work week, I make sure to take leave time in order to participate in the Real Estate Board action, so this is a separate item. Two main concerns for you in relationship to this bill from me as board member, and that is I am the lone citizen representative on the real estate board. The other seven members of the board are related to the real estate industry, and I view my role as the lone citizen person on that board is to watch out for citizens and business in relationship to the way the operations and the licensing and in relation to the complaint resolution process is put forward, to make sure that there's somebody there voicing from the outside that's not from within the industry itself. The last board meeting, which was February 22nd, the real estate board was alerted to this bill 2604. And if I can, we got our packet for, we have a board meeting on Monday, and if they can quote one small piece from the board minutes February 22nd, under item 3D, House Bill 2604, which is an OAR bill, was, quote, dropped, unquote, today. There's no further information available on the bill at this time. We meet in the morning. So this was approximately 10:15 or 10:30 in the morning of February 22nd when the board was made alerted to this particular bill. The board did not vote on this bill. There is no board position on this bill. I'm here because when reading some of the prior information from earlier hearings, it appeared as if other board members were before a legislative committee indicating that the board had taken a vote and also indicating that the board had not heard about it, which is inconsistent. What I'm here to do is try and set the record straight in relationship to that fact. We were made alerted to it, but we did not vote on the bill. And I've asked the agency to flex the calendar of the agenda on Monday to make sure we talk about how board members come before legislative committees and what you're allowed to do or not do if there is no position, and how you represent yourself, because I'm concerned that there's been some mistakes in that particular process. The complaint resolution process within the real estate industry is already industry biased. There are five resolutions when there is a complaint by an individual or by another company against a real estate agent or broker. Five places that there can be resolution. The first three never come back to the consumer to get further information from them other than the complaint. It is all internal to the agency and to the companies. My concern is if we were to weaken the ability within statute for the real estate agency and the investigators to do their job, it becomes even more industry-driven and even more industry-biased. My concern is, again, for the frontline consumer, whether that be a company or whether that be a citizen. One of the things I'm also looking at is towards the future. Measure 37 impacted land use laws and the ability for people to use their property. There is going to be an expectation that those handling and advertising these properties and these developments are doing it right, doing it adequate, and doing it correctly and fairly. And my concern is, are we setting up a situation where there may be a difference in what happens in the future compared to what people may be expecting under the current law? I've noticed in the back that there was a printed -4 amendment to this particular bill. And from citizen representative on the board, speaking only for myself and not the board, that particular -4 amendment will, in my opinion, for citizens and industry, deal with the complaint and the issue resolution process in a way that doesn't cause harm for what we're looking for in the future and doesn't continue to bias the whole system towards the industry to itself. And, Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer questions. I'm not a technical expert in this particular area, as I am on some of the other topics that you'd see me for.
Thank you, Mr. Costello. Senator Stark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm tempted to ask you about speed zones in schools, but I won't. I will ask you about process, because you do wear more than one hat. I recognize the hat you're wearing right now. But I'll ask you about the process when a state agency in one chamber of this building, agency representatives basically say they're okay with, they don't get everything they want necessarily, but they're okay with a negotiation process, through the negotiation process with a bill as it comes to a floor in a particular chamber. And then as the bill moves to the other chamber, discover that they're not okay, or they changed their mind, or as we've heard testified, a deal is a deal. Your experience in this building, I think, is something that is valuable, and I'd just like to have your perspective on that. Our understanding is there was a deal on this bill when it was negotiated on the House side, and then the bill comes to the Senate, and I guess the deal's off. Wish to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, so kind of putting me in a spot of dual roles here. I apologize. But to answer your question, as far as process goes itself from an agency point of view, the real estate agency is a representative body for citizens, consumers, and the industry itself, where people will come forward, multiple people. You had two just before me talking about how there's a relationship, and there are others that have testified. there is the potential of having a bill in one chamber, conversation on a bill, goes to the floor, comes over to the second chamber, and in the intervening time, groups that are relying on that state agency all of a sudden start asking questions or coming up with different interpretations, or what may or may not have been amended and what that ends up meaning. And as a state agency, it's tough to come back around on the second time and say we missed something, or the agreement was on part but not all, or there's a different study, a different review from other people that finally were alerted to the bill. My understanding with this bill is that it wasn't shared with the real estate entity community at large. It was with a certain section and a certain sector, and that others that this impact have had a chance now to look at it and say, wait a minute, time out, and are relying on the real estate agency to be their voice, because that's what they are in statute, is, you know, in part a consumer protection awareness group. It's not comfortable to sit at this table as a state agency on a second hearing on the same bill, or in the second chamber on a bill, and have to explain what the difference was. But I think in part of this case, it had to do with other people looking at it and the agency looking at it again with a closer eye and seeing a different interpretation than what was done the first time.
Questions? Senator Atkins.
Thank you. Did you or any other member of the board testify in the House?
Mr. Chair and Senator Atkinson, I cannot answer the question. I did not testify in the House.
I think there is significant frustration with this agency. Some in the Senate, but many of us have walked over to the House, expressed our frustration. I think on Monday when you have your board meeting that it would be very wise for you to bring up that this agency's behavior in many of our minds is pathetic. And we anticipated getting reeled in. You just cannot say that you just became aware of something when it's been on your desk since February. That's just something to take back to the board meeting.
So, no
other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Harrison, currently come up from Legislative Council. After reviewing the videotapes of the House, again, we got two issues here. We've got the one Senator Atkinson and Senator Starr has pointed out, is the process and the representations. And that's great while we have videotapes so I can watch that. And I share the concerns of my colleagues in that regard. The second issue, which is we're still at the ultimately responsible for good public policy, whether it was right or wrong. And so I asked actually Mr. Ruttlinger originally, and Harrison as well, to look at the two areas of prime dispute, which is knowing or recklessly publishing misleading material, and the gross negligence standard. And we had heard from the Oregon Association of Realtors attorney, Mr. Farmer, and I believe speaking on their behalf. And also we heard from the Department of Justice different opinions as to whether, in fact, the consumers were being harmed as a result of this. So, Mr. Carley, if you could give us your evaluation of that those two pieces, those items of dispute here, and give us your interpretation of whether the standards have been reduced, and if so, you know, if that is significant that this committee would then deliberate on.
Thank you. Harrison Conley, Deputy Legislative Counsel. As you mentioned, you had a chance to talk with Mr. Ruttlinger earlier today, and then I talked with him. Didn't get a chance to talk with you or Ms. Van Winkle until just a few minutes ago. But what I started with this, let me start with a little caveat. Of course, when I was drafting this provision, I was essentially presented with, we have 33 existing sections providing disciplinary standards or criteria. And I was presented with materials that essentially just remove these and replace them with a new set. So as a non-policymaker, I did not spend a lot of time comparing the new standards with the existing standards. I looked at the new standards to determine that they were coherent, they made sense as a whole, there were no obvious holes. So I didn't spend a lot of time initially thinking about the policy implications of changing the standards and criteria. As a result of the discussions this morning, I spent a little time trying to match the existing 33 to some provision in the new language. And for example, one of the things I see is that subsection 3 of the new language is something of a catch-all. We have a number of provisions which, sort of based on this Ask Me testimony that I reviewed, appear to be written in response to some specific disciplinary circumstance that occurred. Subsection 3 now would simply say that disregard or violation of any provision of the Real Estate Act is a grounds for discipline. So that may catch any number of these 33 that are listed with very specific fact circumstances. They may be covered. I did not have a chance to really review the language of the Real Estate Act to get there. But as you say, as I hear you saying, what you're really concerned about is where we've changed the standard from negligent to gross negligence or to recklessness or dropped either of those and just had an intentional or a knowing standard. In that regard, I guess I would draw your attention to Section 5 of the bill, which I think was done by amendment on the House side, and I believe some part of that even was done by a conceptual amendment, if I recall correctly. Based on the information you have from the Department of Justice, the gross negligence draws in a bit of a state of mind issue. That is, negligence is simply a failure to meet the standards of the agency, the standards or criteria set out. Gross negligence brings in some sort of indifference to meeting those standards, indifference to the harm that might be brought in, and recklessness probably ramps that up a little more, probably wanton indifference to meeting the standards of the profession. Given that Section 5 calls for the agency to discover material facts and to not deal with discipline on the basis of conclusions of violation or conclusion of the grounds, it's not clear to me that gross negligence, that the state of mind, can ever be established fully and firmly as a material fact. That's always something of a conclusion. So it may be that some of those standards will not work well with this requirement that discipline can only occur when a material fact has been absolutely established.
Senator Montesantis.
Yes. With that caveat, I had spoken with the real estate advocates industry and got their opinion on this gross negligence, and it appeared to me to make sense, but I'm not a lawyer. I'm glad to have you give this input to me. To me, I would like the bill to move forward, but I think that it will only move forward if we adopt the dash A4 amendments that would get rid of deleting knowingly and recklessly and deleting gross, and then there will be then a conference committee, obviously, and then hopefully the both sides could take care of it there. So this bill is to prevent mortgage broker fraud and real estate fraud cases. And since talking with the industry, I got a lot of different cases that have been put forward to them. And it's very interesting to see the types of things that are where there's actually plea bargaining, you know, where they're actually a realtor pleaded guilty to first-degree theft, felony, and execution of documents by deception, which is a misdemeanor, and in exchange then the state agreed to drop one count each of racketeering and conspiracy to commit first-degree theft and two counts each of first-degree theft and mortgage broker fraud. I mean, all of a sudden when I started reading all of these, I would rather err on caution because I'm looking at it from a consumer protection point of view, and I understand that if you look at line 30 on page 6, knowingly and recklessly publish material misleading or untruthful advertising, the industry pointed out that this was actually, if you were concerned about that, if you go into line 22 to through 24, even if there's any misrepresentations or false promises, it looks like those types of things are going to be covered no matter what. So I see that. But I do feel that gross negligence, now that I've had your explanation of it, that gross should be deleted and negligence should stay in.
Other questions for counsel? Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is, is there anything that the changes in this bill make as far as the standards of discipline? Is there anything that a realtor could do that he would be punished for, he or she would be punished for before, that they couldn't be punished for under this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I cannot answer that question absolutely with a yes or no. There are absolutely places in this where the standard of conduct is lowered. I do not see anything, although I may further review might change my perspective. I don't see a way in which the standards of brokers have been raised in any way, and I do see some respects in which the standards have been lower. Another one which I should have mentioned probably was the on page 6, subsection 1 of the new language.
Exactly. Doesn't that catch, Mr. Chair, Mr. Connolly, doesn't that catch virtually everything? I mean, if a realtor makes material misrepresentations or false promises, I mean, doesn't that catch virtually any time that a realtor may be dishonest or...
Well, in comparing that section to the sort of comparable section in the existing law, which is also section 1, a material misrepresentation under current law would be a ground for discipline without regard to whether harm in fact occurs. Now, we have to have a reasonable probability of damage or harm based on the material misrepresentation. So I guess the answer is yes, that is a way in which a broker might be disciplined under current law and might not be disciplined here. It does lower the standard of conduct.
Any other questions? Well, Senator Deckard?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of unfair to ask Harrison, but maybe someone else, in Harrison or Mr. Connolly, you may know the answer. So what, I'm always looking for real-life examples of what could be, the, I guess, on Senator Mona Sanderson's question of gross negligence versus negligence. Can you, although I realize it'd be like you asking me and I couldn't, think
he's
of
an attorney. What do you mean? It's not like he's asking you.
I can get creative if I need to. Any examples come to mind, and maybe another witness would be able to give me one of how this would play out in practical terms if we pass this and change it from gross to, or from negligence to gross negligence, or vice versa.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, again, no, I don't know that I can give you a clear example, but I can, again, focus on the idea that negligence is just a failure to meet some professional standard, where gross negligence is going to require some additional state of mind, some level of disregard for one's obligation to meet the professional standards.
I have an example I'd like to know.
You done, Senator Deckard?
Well, you may proceed.
I'm ready to yield the floor.
Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Atkinson, and then I'm going to ask the director.
And I don't know if this is... say you have a couple that doesn't speak English, and they get... a broker gets them to sign a piece of paper saying you are buying this house. Little did they know that the payments, the $1,000 a month that they were paying each month, it was actually going to pay for the mortgage of someone else. So they were paying something in it. Well, it turns out they lost everything. Is that have anything to do with negligence or gross negligence? No. By not properly informing this person that what they were signing really wasn't what they thought that they were signing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, you scare me very much when you ask me to make those kinds of subjective judgments. It does, however, strike me that goes beyond
negligent.
A mere negligent act. Right. That person has an obligation, that licensee has an obligation to inform the clients at some level, and knowing that they don't speak the language and don't understand the terms, the written terms there, certainly seems to me to go beyond, to add a level of indifference to, if that constitutes a failure to do something that meets the standards, that goes beyond simple failure to meet.
I thought maybe there would be a simple example of what was.
Well, if I could follow up on that, I guess a little. I think Senator Deckert was going in the right direction. It sounds like there are some issues with the agency, but of course the agency typically enforces these. The agency has been involved in those cases, so they would certainly be in a better position to try to tell you an actual example of something that goes beyond simple negligence.
Sir Atkinson?
Let me try this one on. I think you're right. I think the agency's got some real problems here. It is in their hands, but I think this example that I read, this comes from Ashland, shows why we need to have both words in there. This is an example. Two real estate agents in the same office failed to renew their licenses on time. One did so because he did not receive forwarded mail, and the other through simple error. No member of the public was harmed in either case, and in both cases the agents worked with partners whose license was active throughout. Both agents understood their mistake and fully expected some level of discipline. The first agent was offered a $10,000 fine for his offense, while the other agent was offered a $100 fine. The agency now claims that it's corrected the issue, but in recent Oregon Real Estate News Journal, there were five separate fines for late license renewal that ranged from $200 to $4,500. And then this person says that there needs to be fairness, consistency, and objectivity in the process. I think that is a good example that argues why we need to have both standards up there. Certainly, one person who's in the case of Senator Montes Anderson is trying to deceive, and then, in simple, making a mistake. Is that, am I reading, is that example, I realize I'm trying not to make you as uncomfortable as Senator Deckert was, or whoever.
Chair, Senator Atkinson, I guess I'm curious, maybe I didn't follow your example well enough, but which of those people was fined $10,000 and which fined $100? The one who didn't receive the mail?
Two of them. It didn't say, I just read you what I read. As
an interesting distinction. One didn't receive mail reminding them of the termination of the license.
The fact that they both made a mistake.
Just didn't renew.
Yeah, they both made a mistake. I mean, is that harmful, gross, throw the book at them?
Well, it's certainly simple negligence. Failure to renew the license is simple negligence.
Uh-huh.
You know, again, you're asking me to be subjective. I'm not sure that I see either of those as gross negligence. But if one of those is, it is the person who received the notice and then didn't act.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Conley. Appreciate that very much. We never have enough hours in the day. Mr. Taylor, if you come forward, please. And by the way, colleagues, if the Department of Justice did provide us a matrix on different standards. Colleagues, we're going to be moving on here because we have other people that we have also promised obligations to meet today. Mr. Taylor, you know, I would just, in your response and in questions from the committee, would be fine. You know, I appreciate how difficult these things are working with different interest groups. And again, as I mentioned, I did review the the public work on this bill. I do share my colleagues, after watching it and hearing it, colleagues, that I do not believe you adequately expressed these issues when the House met. And while I thought in some of the representations were not totally accurate against the agency, I do not believe that you met your standard of concern for this bill as this moves through this process, which is why we're here today. You know, it's, as you can tell, has created a lot of issues here. He said, she said, and it creates a real problem for us then to get back and actually get to our real job, which is to solve the policy issues involved. And I would first of all just like to ask for your comments on how your agency has handled this bill. And I understand the issues of when it was dropped. I understand all that. But you also have a duty to, look after the interests of your agency and making sure that all the appropriate information is clearly articulated.
Mr. Chairman, first, for the record, my name is Scott Taylor. I'm the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner, and I do apologize for my absence on Tuesday. Regarding your question, I too am concerned that this issue or this misunderstanding seems to have come forward, and I think the best way I can take you to it is to the second work group meeting that we had with Representative Kitts. And at that time, I made the statement, as I recall, that we had been able to reach consensus on every issue except for one, that being the gross negligence issue that we've been discussing today. I presented Representative Kitts with a position paper from the agency, which I believe was handed to you on Tuesday. It also had a couple proposed amendments that had some definitions. The Realtors Association also presented one which related to a case called the Fazzolari case. At that point, my remark to Representative Kitts is we cannot agree on this issue. We walked out of the meeting with that belief that that's where we were. Representative Kitts, I believe, on Tuesday testified that I said I would not fall on my spear over an issue, and that is true. What I said is I would not fall on my spear over Section 2, which relates to the disputed earnest money situation. And I did say that. But when we walked out of there, I was under the distinct impression that he understood that we were not together on Section 3 with that particular language. And I've also looked at the tapes on the hearing the following day, or I'm sorry, two following days, I think it was. And what I see there is the context of the question related to Section 5 of the bill, and the agency said, yes, they were on board with that change, with a conceptual change that was made at the hearing. And then they went right to a vote. There was never a question asked, and I'm sorry, maybe we should have said, but we don't agree with Section 3. However, in my opinion, it was clear to Representative Kitts that we did not.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say, I don't dispute that, because I saw that. And you were talking about that section. But if this was as major of an issue as it is, and apparently is, I think we needed to make that clear at that time. What I'm going to do, colleagues, we are split. This committee is split on this piece of legislation, and I do not feel comfortable moving it forward, because I'm not going to weigh in and make that decision on something that I think going forward as is has serious doubts of passage on this floor of the Senate at the moment. What I am going to do is I will see to it that this bill does come back. I will allow it to return. I'm Oregon Association of Realtors and the agency, and I'm going to ask legislative counsel to be involved. I want this issue, these two issues, solved. And in 2 weeks, we're going to have a product that ensures that we provide appropriate standard of care for our clients and I mean this, which is in this case the citizens for us and for you, different representations. Make sure that if there are standards of care that are being misrepresented, that we're really not lowering the standard. I want that to know too. I don't want false accusations of that someone's, and I know the industry, and the industry is, and I know the association works very, very hard to do a good job in representing their clients. So, and I don't like the idea that someone is suggesting they're trying to lower their standard. Now, we may have different interpretations on that. I'm not an attorney, but Harrison, I'm going to ask you to work with this and come up with what that answer is that is proper. And then we will bring that bill back, and I want and expect every one of you to come up and support that work product. And that's all I can do right now, because I do not feel comfortable, playing the moderator of that issue. Okay? With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2604. And we're going to open up I'm going to move ahead to Senate Bill and open up Senate Bill 408, public hearing. And let's see, I had it here before me. Did I lose it already?
No.
Okay, we've had this bill before us. We brought it back. I'm going to ask Mr. Pitt to come forward. Mr. Nelson to come forward. Is Mark not here? Okay, Mr. Pitt, we'll proceed with you.
For the record, I'm Louis Pitt, Jr., Director of Government Affairs and Planning for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. Chair and committee, with your indulgence, could please invite some people that can supply some of the details to this. We have...
what I'd like, Mr. Pitt, and I'm sorry, I need, and I apologize, we're in that rush committee again. If we're going to get the bill, we need to move on. We've had this bill before. We had some dispute on a few areas. We have now got an amendment for those few areas. That's what I would like to have addressed, and what has changed in this bill before, and then Mr. Nelson, who has signed up against the bill, for his comments on that. So if that's you, Mr. Pitt, that's great. Or if you have somebody else, please ask them to come forward. Yes.
Yes. Jim, could you... Mr. Chair, we have Jim Noteboom, who's the tribal attorney and enterprise attorney for the biomass project, and he's here, and he's just kind of the legalist that looked at the words shall and may and wordage like that. And,
great. So. Thank you, Mr. Pitt. Thank you, Mr. Noteboom. Welcome again.
My name is Jim Noteboom. I'm tribal attorney for the Warm Springs Tribe, and we support the bill as amended. And there were several things done. One, there was a...
Well, you mean the proposed amendment?
Yeah, proposed amendment. There were legislative intent or findings included that make clear what the intent of the legislature is in this. In addition, there was a change with regard to the PUC, and it now, as written, gives the PUC discretion as to whether or not to allow any above-market costs. It also limits the amount of the subsidy to a sum that is over for a five-year period, one-third of 1% of the annual revenues of the utility.
Okay. As you recall, committee, there was some concern when this bill came to the floor about some of those limitations. Mr. Nelson.
Welcome. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. ICNU still opposes the legislation as the amendment is proposed. While we're happy to see the word may come for the shell, there are still other concerns with the bill. As we indicated previously, the bill says the electric company may agree to pay for the electricity at a price necessary to make the project economically feasible. It then requires that the electric company that purchases electricity shall include the cost of electricity and the cost used to set rates. It is correct that they have changed and allowed the PUC discretion in terms of whether they shall allow the recovery. We still believe that this particular subsidy, whether it was offered for the tribes or offered for any other cogeneration plant, is still that. It would be a subsidy. I want to point out that in the new language, it says if either of the two electric companies with the highest number of customers in Oregon enter into a contract under this section, the amount of the cost recovered may not exceed an amount equal to 1/3 of 1% of the annual revenue. What 1/3 of 1% means is it's $3 to $5 million a year. And it is correct that they've limited this subsidy to a 5-year period of time. But that is a $9 to $15 million subsidy that will be borne by all three classes of ratepayers, commercial, residential, and industrial. Because the language still remains in the bill, the commission shall allow the recovery of those costs from all classes of ratepayers. I just would submit, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that we have cogeneration plants all over this state. They have to meet market rates. If this bill was extended to all cogeneration plants in the state, then that would be something that we would look at. But it would still mean somebody, that you could operate those plants inefficiently, and somebody else is going to pay for that inefficient operation. Our cogeneration plants could, you could substitute this for, and say, for example, Weyerhaeuser instead of tribal lands, and that would not be something that would be acceptable to you. Our point here is that no class of customer should subsidize to the tune of $9 to $15 million, and in this case, all three customers will have to do that subsidy.
Thank you. Questions for the tribal representatives or Mr. Nelson? Senator Atkinson.
Thanks. I gotta say, I really like this bill, and I'm glad that we're working on it. But is there any way to satisfy both sides on this? Is there any way to take to not have a bill put on to ratepayers? I mean, is there any way to do this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, I believe there is. That's what the Energy Trust is there for. The PUC is working on an avoided cost case right now, which may in fact set the rate higher, and they may qualify with this project. And the Energy Trust is set there to help subsidize programs that aren't market-based. So we believe there are mechanisms within the PUC today and the Energy Trust that you've set up and endorsed, and that's what they're there for. They can apply for loans from the Department of Energy. They can put together a package, which others have done, to make this thing economically feasible for them. But to come in with a piece of legislation that simply pushes all of it off on somebody else, the tribes, and we're supportive of what their goal is, but to say that we're going to pay the tribes in effect $9 to $15 million above market, and it's all going to come from us, we just don't think that's right. And again, there are places to go for this project, and it's a legitimate project, but not this way.
Would you please respond to that?
Yeah. It's our intent to bring this project in under market. That's what we want to do. But we're putting this project together. We don't know that we're going to be able to do that. We will go to the Energy Trust. We will go to lots of other entities. We will work with the utility as a partner. And we're going to do everything in our power to bring it in under market. But that may not be possible. We may not be able to get there. What this bill does is gives the utility and the PUC, considering the larger benefits of this project, and it's quite unlike other cogeneration projects. This is really a forest health project with an ancillary benefit of a cogeneration of a biomass facility. We believe that working in partnership with the utility, with state agencies and others, that there's a good chance we can bring it into the market, and that is our goal. This is not, the intent of this is not that it's a check for $9 to $15 million. The intent is that if the PUC believes that it's appropriate, and we understand we have to make a case for that, that they could allow some costs above market. And this does set a cap on what those could be. But the case has to be made.
Would it be appropriate to put in one more safety break before that would happen into the bill?
Depends what safety break is, I suppose.
Well, I'm wondering if there isn't a middle of the road here that we could get to.
Chairman,
I mean, I really like the bill. I really like, especially on the forest cleanup side. I like what it does on Warm Springs. I mean, I like the bill. I'm just trying to, on the policy side, get to where the middle is. Is it possible? Let me ask.
I don't know. We've asked others for suggestions of what it would take to do this, because this is not something we're trying to ram down people's throat. We think it's good for the forest, good for all citizens. There's a lot of reasons to do this bill, and we're certainly willing to work with anybody to try and do that.
On that point, correct me if I'm wrong, as I read the amendment, the PUC will make that decision. I mean, you may ask for a certain recovery, and they could say no.
Yes. That's right. That's correct.
Okay. And that's a public process. Thank you. Gentlemen, I'd like to ask Mr. Bisson, had it signed up as a neutral party. Is he still here? And then I'll see what the committee wants to do. And then we're going to move ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board, representing residential customers, and we had serious concerns about the bill as it passed out of committee before, and we appreciated the proponents' willingness to bring the bill back to committee and work with our attorney and our rate staff to settle our concerns. And we were primarily concerned about the discretion of the PUC being taken away, and that has been solved by having the language of May in the bill. We share some of our industrial fellow customers' concerns about the amount, but we also understand that is an amount that we don't know what the amount is, and that's something we're willing to argue about over the PUC if the tribe feels necessary to come to the PUC. We'll go through that process and argue about that amount there. Hopefully, by the time they get there, it'll be a small enough amount that we won't even feel the need to show up. But that's an argument to be saved for a later day. So for this piece of legislation, with the changes that are in the Dash A4 amendments, we will be neutral on the bill.
Questions for Mr. Bissonnette? Okay, thank you very much. We are falling a little bit behind schedule. We are in public hearing. Is the wish of the business committee going to work session? Or do you want to give me some indication?
I can tell you, Mr. Chair, I would be, and it pains me to do it, but I would be a no, because I just think it's bad policy and bad precedence. As good of a project it is and as important as it is, to me it's just the precedence of, we've thought this through. We set out a strategic system for the state, and that's how we set up the Energy Trust. And I'd be willing to sign a letter to the Energy Trust to say, give every consideration to good projects like this. This is what their intent and purpose is for. But to me, for us to come in on particular projects that we're very, very interested and intrigued by, and to pass legislation, to me, alters the basic framework that we have in place. As good as an idea as it is, and as warm as feelings I have for the Warm Springs Tribe, it's just, for me, it would violate. So I guess Senator Atkinson asked if there's a middle ground, and I kept thinking, is there? And to me, that's what the whole 1149 process was, that trying to get that middle ground in place.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Starr, your thoughts?
Well, I'd love to see a compromise that accomplished what Senator Atkinson was trying to accomplish. That would be my preference. We're under a tight time schedule, and I don't know if the chair is willing to hold this bill and see if the tribe and Mr. Nelson and others might be able to find that. If the chair really would like to move the bill, I would more than likely support the amendment that's going in the bill and moving the bill. But I guess my first choice would be not have to have a fight.
Senator Atkinson.
I like pressure. Send them out in the hall for 30 minutes. See what they can do.
Senator Wallace Anderson.
I do have a concern regarding the rate payers. The amount, I thought it was 3 to 5 million, but now it's 9 to 15 million rate payers would have to subsidize. So I would like a compromise. I'd like something that would protect the rate payers a little bit better.
Okay. You've heard the wishes of the committee. I share that sentiment. I think this is a great project. I think it does things that we want to accomplish. But we've had this bill on the floor once before. It is clearly not ripe, as they say in the legal phrase, right? So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 408, and I, rather than move the bill forward at this moment, I'm going to ask that, as Senator Atkinson first suggested, that you folks, the tribe, and particularly with both Mr. Bissonnette and ICNU, work together and solve that issue. If there is some elasticity in which this committee has to make the final decision, we will do that. But I would like to ask you to work a little bit harder on that issue, and we'll ask the Senate President to bring this bill back. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to close public hearing, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 922.
This is
today's?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Senate Bill 922, and I believe we have the insurance industry here, Mr. Gardner, whose amendments we have, actually. Where is he? Is he here today? There he is, Mr. Gardner. Wrote, I understand, pretty much this amendment.
Actually, it came from a work group.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
All right. And who else was part of this discussion? Mr. Elkins. But were you guys involved? You guys were involved in this, weren't you? All right. Okay, well, let's come forward. Mr. Gardner, please proceed, 922, yes. On the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, representing Hertz Corporation. And the amendment that you have before you was based on some language which the Law Commission provided, which we tweaked, and which Legislative Council finalized. I must tell you, though, that while this language is okay with Hertz, we did have an agreement with the industry, in particular with Catrala, Daryl Fuller, which we fully disclosed at the work group meeting. And the effect, the essence of that agreement was that if the industry at large could not sign off on it, even if it was, you know, okay with Hertz, we would agree that we'd not support the amendment. And the representative for Catrala, Al Elkins, is here, and he can report to you what his membership has their reaction to it. So I have to be very candid in saying that this was our language, but we had an agreement that we would not support any move forward that did not have the concurrence of the broader car rental industry.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gardner, and thank you for your openness on this. So we have an amendment. We had this issue before us. I think it's clear that Hertz supports this, and the auto dealers, they don't support the language. They support the language, but they don't support moving forward because someone still doesn't like it, and that's Mr. Elkins. So, Mr. Elkins, welcome. Please tell us what it is specifically in the amendment that is not appropriate.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Car and Truck Rental Leasing Association of Oregon. I have five members that I sent this out to. I've heard back from only one, and that was Enterprise, and I have to go through their corporate offices on the East Coast, their attorneys. They had some questions about I sent this out late Monday night when I received it late in the afternoon. I got back some information yesterday. They asked me some more questions. They had troubles with lines 7 through 13 on the dash 2s, and they had more questions, and they're still working through what all this means. This is the third amendment or third draft of language that we've sent. They've all been different, and I think that they're still trying to find out amongst themselves or ascertain exactly what the target is, what the problem is that we're trying to address here. So each time we come up with different language, I think we focus a little bit on a different target. So it's been a confusing process, but that's where they are with this set of words, this language.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I only have the dash ones.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Elkins.
Thank you.
Could I have our two attorneys, our opposite side attorneys, back up, please? The insurance industry and the Oregon Travelers Association. If you could give us a synopsis of the amendment and your evaluation of it.
The amendment.
Please identify yourself.
Neil Jack.
I know you've been here so long.
Oregon Trial Lawyers. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the amendment was done at the request of Hertz. They wanted to make it clear, and Mr. Morrell, correct me if I misstate anything. They wanted to make it clear that the coverage that would be mandated by the bill would be secondary coverage. What that means is that if the person who rents the car and then gets in the accident, if they have their own insurance policy, that would be the primary coverage that would take care of whatever damages resulted from the accident. And that was why the language was changed, and the actual language that used in the dash 2 amendments is the language that Hertz proposed, and we've got no problem with that, because as far as we're concerned, that was our intent all along, that the primary coverage kicks in first, and only if there isn't primary coverage by the person who has the car gets in the accident, then the minimum requirements of the financial responsibility law would be met by the rental company.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, I'm Steve Merle, an attorney employed by the Claims Department of State Farm Insurance, and I think that Mr. Jackson has explained to you exactly what we're trying to do. I think at this point it would probably be helpful to know what the objections to the amendment are, and I think Mr. Elkins was quite upfront with at the work group that was going to take some time, and he was working on time pressure to get that, but it would help us if we knew what they were to try to solve the problem.
Mr. Elkins, would you come back up, please? Because we've got your larger industry folks. We've got warring parties who are all saying this works. And I appreciate the objection. I want to know what the objection is to. I mean, that's an important part of it.
Mr. Chair, for the record, again, Al Elkins representing Catrala. They told me they had problems with the second sentence, lines 7 through 13. I sent them back a number of questions, specifically asking what it was they were looking at, what they were concerned about. I have not heard back from them, and so that's as far as I can go. And I tried to explain to them exactly what the problem is, what we were addressing, and that's all I have for you. I'm sorry.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
You're saying of the dash twos they
yes.
had. Questions, lines 7 through 13.
Right.
It doesn't seem a self-insurer is required to provide the minimum payments established under ORS, etc., only when the motor vehicle liability insurance policy of a customer of the self-insurer or an operator of the self-insurer does not provide the minimum required payments established. I'm not sure what that's saying to me, that you would be objectionable.
I mean, it sounds like you don't want to pay the claim is what it sounds like. I'm not an attorney, but you guys are there. I mean, let's talk about this. Is that...
Mr. Chairman, if I could, Neil Jackson again for the Oregon Trial Lawyers. As I testified before to the committee, I really believe the Haynes versus TriMet case mandates exactly what the first part of this bill does. I think that the rental companies are going to have to provide the minimum coverage if the driver doesn't have their own policy. The second part, and what is particular of interest to us, is the second part of this bill, what it does. What the second part does, it changes the law presently. if you get involved in an accident and there is a minimum coverage policy on the rental vehicle and the rental vehicle's at fault, you now, today, cannot turn around. If you've got your own policy that's worth $100,000 limit, you can't collect a minimum policy, which is $25,000 under the statute. You can't then turn around and go to your own insurance company to be made whole. There's a hole in the law right now. And the second part of this bill fixes that and provides that you will be able to go to your own policy to get up to your own policy limits, which you've paid for. So there's two parts to this bill. The first one simply mandates that where there isn't a policy, the rental company has to step in and provide the minimum limits. The second part allows you to make an underinsured motorist claim if you've got sufficient limits on your own policy to make sure that you're made whole from whatever happened in the accident. So it's two parts, and they're both very important.
Chair Metzger, if I could kind of elaborate on that. What this whole idea of the Law Commission started out with is we're trying to solve a problem that this is a small subset of. Currently under underinsured motorist coverage, a self-insured car is not an underinsured or uninsured car. In most cases, that doesn't present a problem because if like a large commercial self-insurer causes the damage, they're solvent and they can pay the claim. Where it became more of a problem is in the case where a person is renting a car and you don't know what kind of coverage that person has. What this was intended to do was make sure that there was at least the minimum limits of liability coverage through self-insurance by requiring the self-insurer to provide that in the event that the driver did not have his own coverage. Then, once the minimum self-insurance was paid, you'd be able to go to your own underinsured motorist coverage and get coverage so that it allowed the underinsured motorist law to act in a rational fashion. It operates when there isn't much coverage and there shouldn't be for somebody who's renting a car. There should be just minimum coverage. And that's what we're trying to do, and we're trying to make clear in this line 7 through 13 that is the only obligation. 806.070 is a schedule of payments that says that you have to have at least $25,000 per person for bodily injuries, $50,000 per accident, and then $10,000 for property damage.
Okay. This is what we're going to do with this bill. I think this is good policy, and after we've had our discussion earlier, I think this is good policy. We've got the opposite end of the legal system supporting this. We've got large rental car people supporting this. We have the automobile supporting this. And I understand, Mr. Elkins, your people don't, but I don't know why.
Okay.
Now, what I'm going to tell you is that we're going to move this bill, but I am going to give you the opportunity to find out what those arguments are. And so that we can see what it is that we're dealing with. Mr. Gardner, if you could work also with Mr. Elkins, since you're in the same industry, and with members of the insurance industry, to identify, tell your people we need to know. I don't feel comfortable not moving what I think is a good piece of legislation just for argument that doesn't want to be articulated. And find out what that is, and if we can address it, we will address it. And if not, we will make a decision on it. But I will give that to you. Please give some specifics on that, and we'll do that. We'll close the public hearing. Senate Bill 922. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 572.
Are you moving this?
Not
are you going to move it?
Not today.
Not today?
I think it's a movement. But it won't move today.
Okay.
Let's see. Who we have coming up here? This obviously doesn't even have the proponents.
No, it doesn't.
Do we have more than one page?
No. That would be one sheet.
Okay.
That was the only sheet that was there.
Mr. Glashman isn't signed up, but I will. I believe he would like to speak on this bill. So we'll ask Mr. Brian Glashman to come forward. Before we begin the discussion, two things. First of all, we're going to be working off a Dash 7 amendment. Please, I hope you all have a copy of the Dash 7 amendment to Senate Bill 572. I also, before we begin discussion, want to declare a potential conflict of interest because my firm does work for nursing employers who will be impacted by this legislation should it go forward. Mr. Glashman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Glashman, representing the Oregon Council or Oregon Nurses Association. I'm sorry.
Do we have on today?
Starting to put on a different hat today. It's been a long day. What's being passed out to you, or will be passed out to you, is a series of memos to the chair and to legislative council that will show an evolution on this bill from when you first heard it. And I think it helps you understand from the original design in which you had a number of folks coming forward with concerns that perhaps were legitimate concerns as far as technical writing in the bill. And I think we now get down to whether or not you support the foundation of the bill, which is whether or not there should be established a process in which we understand, know, and are able to track whether an assault, and that's a criminal assault against a nurse, has occurred. At the same time, the Dash 7s, as you'll see as we go through this, these memos, also sets up a process in which if, in fact, the patient that has created the disturbance, created the physical contact, is not able to understand the consequences of their action, but it sets up a different process. And I know there was some concern by a number of folks, and we were very sensitive to that, that if, in fact, you have an Alzheimer's patient that, in fact, acts up, beats somebody up, or a patient that's psychotic, schizophrenic, or whatever, and they, in fact, act out and cause an assault, that, in fact, we weren't running them through the legal system because of a couple of reasons. One is they don't deserve to be in the legal system. Two, it imposes additional cost on not only the police investigating that and coming out, but also the judicial system. So with that, let me go through very quickly the memo. The first one you'll see is dated 4-7 to the chair and committee staff. And as you go through that, you'll see that what we attempted to do is take some technical concerns that were brought forward by the Hospital Association and make those changes based upon those comments, along with some changes that were requested by the Board of Nursing on the second page and the state police as far as their ability to collect data. As you see, going through this, the whole litany of changes, and I don't know that you have enough time or want me to go through every single change here, but where there was a technical change, for example, line 6, delete bodily and use physical, that was a change that was suggested by the Hospital Association to more accurately reflect what the statutes describe as an assault. The second piece that was totally eliminated was a section in the original bill that, although is not under the current definition of an assault, dealt with the menacing, the threat of an assault, and it was actually in the original bill was wrapped into an assault. We deleted that, so we're really just talking about a pure assault here in this particular bill. And again, I don't know if you want me to go through all of these, but line 9 and 10, about two-thirds of the way down that page, there was concern that the way it was listed, it was physical and medical only well-being, and we wanted to add and make sure that, in fact, mental health was listed in there too. And then going on to the last page, there was, again, as I'd mentioned, some concern by the Oregon State Police because there's a requirement by the Oregon State Police for them to be able to gather this data in a way that's readily retrievable at the end so that the employer can be able to collect that information from the state police and be able to then make the corrective action or write the report that they're required to under this bill in a yearly fashion. The state police, after meeting with them on two occasions, had indicated that they were in the process of changing over their system of gathering data from local jurisdictions, and I may use the wrong description of it, but I think it was Ombris is what they called it, but it's a computer gathering system, reporting system from local jurisdictions, and they said that not all jurisdictions were on board at this point, and that it would be easy at the point when jurisdictions were on for them to have an identifier that said this assault was against a nurse. They currently collect information if it's an assault against a public safety officer. They're required by federal law, but they said they would just have to add an additional identifier. So we originally talked about having a pilot project, moving it back and having a pilot project in a particular jurisdiction. We finally settled upon not the route on the bottom of this page, but said let's set back the date for them to have that identifier and have local jurisdictions be able to report that way. The second email dash that's dated 4-19 is the result of, again, further discussions with the parties on how to deal, as I had talked about, with the ability to make a determination about whether or not the person that's done the assault has the ability to make that distinction, that cognitive distinction between whether they did something right or wrong. We've heard evidence from our members that it's not unusual for a patient who may in fact be in a psychiatric facility to be able to make that determination and actually make a threat and say, on Friday, I beat everybody else in this facility up, and on Friday it's your turn. And do they have the ability to make a determination what's right or wrong, or folks are saying, yeah, at some point there is that line, and somebody has to make a determination on that. So this memo was an attempt to make that distinction between what is a criminal assault and an incident that still would be tracked, and we would be able to figure out that there was an incident, but it wouldn't go through the criminal justice system. And then the final one is an email in response to an additional conversation that I had with some of the folks in the facilities, that after the Dash 3 draft, that in fact the language was not clear enough in that it was a separate but parallel system as far as being able to track those folks. So it wouldn't be one on top of the other, that you would have a criminal process going and an internal process going on in the cases when it involved the patients with limited capacity to make that determination. And so, as you can see from my email to committee staff and subsequently then to legislative council, you have the Dash 7s in front of you. And that's what the Dash 7s do, is make all the corrections in the Dash 1 that were asked for, the Dash 3s, and then clarify on the mental health side so that it's clear that it's a separate process. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. DeLashman. And committee members, just want you to know, and I appreciate this very much, we could have a room filled with nurses today, and I specifically, because of their time crunch, asked Mr. DeLashman, you know, to handle the testimony singly rather than a lot of folks here. So,
Chair, I do want to recognize some nursing students,
yes,
from the Linfield Good Sam School,
oh,
who are interested in the legislative process and just happened to pick this bill to come and watch.
Welcome. Today. Thank you very much.
And that was not an anti-nursing statement.
Yeah.
We welcome nurses.
We welcome them. We welcome them.
Want nurses. We have nurses in our, on our committee.
And I also want to also thank Mr. DeLashman, because I know it was uncomfortable at times, but was really pressing the Oregon Nurses Association to really look at the differentiation between assaults on by patients, general population, as opposed to those mentally ill. Because I know the compassion of care that my own wife, who's a nurse, and has talked to me about, and things that we don't want to be calling the police all the time when someone we know that is their condition. And I appreciate you working on that and differentiating that. I very much appreciate that. Questions for Mr. DeLashman at the moment? Thank you. Let's ask Bruce Bishop, David Fiscom, and Sarah Reeder. By the way, members, I intend to be voting on this bill at 5 to 3, so just to let you know, because the other committee comes in at 3 o'clock.
So we can leave?
No, I don't want you to leave.
Bless you.
And again, I would ask you, don't repeat each other, but and I know you're very good at that, so please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I'm passing out to you rather voluminous testimony, and I will not read every dot and jot. I do need to apologize to the committee. In our previous testimony, I misstated the effect of the bill on the Oregon State Hospital under the definition of a hospital. I've corrected the testimony for your record.
Yes, and you had previously mentioned, pass that on, and we appreciate that.
Yes. The Hospital Association continues to have a number of concerns with the bill, and that's not because we condone violence in our facilities, but we think this bill doesn't provide a remedy to that problem that's actually going to be workable in practice. The bill, I will identify just a few of the issues and not try to nitpick the bill at this point, because I appreciate the committee's time and patience in that regard. The bill's scope is limited to hospitals, home health agencies, and to certain other agencies. Under the Dash 7 amendments, that would be expanded beyond county health departments to certain public and private entities providing certain kinds of services. But then, for example, in Section 2, Sub 1, the reports would be limited to those that occur in hospitals and in patient homes for home health agencies. And so it seems as if that whole cluster of third agencies, which are the public or private entities providing community and public health services, aren't swept into the reporting requirement somehow. So they're a target, but their reports don't get included the way the bill is drafted. Section 2 sub 6 mandates law enforcement reports to all public agencies that license hospitals and home health agencies and to all professional licensing boards for people who work in hospitals. Even though the scope of the bill is limited to nursing staff, I read that provision as saying that law enforcement has to provide a report to every health profession licensing board, board of medical examiners, board of clinical social workers, any practitioner group that works in a hospital, not necessarily the practitioner group responsible for licensing the staff person who may have been assaulted. The in section 3, subsection 1, there is disclosure of protected health information. I frankly find that section very confusing in trying to understand what it does. In the first subsection...
Which section are we in?
Section 3.
It'll be page 4 on the dash 7 center.
Subsection 1 of that section limits the disclosure without the without authorization of the person to the patient's protected health information. And then subsection 2 allows disclosure of protected health information that's directly relevant to the investigation, but not necessarily, as I read it, to the assailant's protected health information. So if there's a law enforcement investigation going on, I gather that this would allow law enforcement to get anybody's protected health information in the facility, not just the assailants, or not just the victims. Section 4 mandates peace officers to report assaults and to assure that the reports are entered into the Oregon Uniform Crime Reporting Program. Under another provision in the bill, section 2 sub 7, nursing staff is immunized for good faith reports. There is not a similar provision for peace officers who take a report, and they are directly responsible for getting that entered into the Uniform Crime Reporting System. Now, there may be general immunization for law enforcement in that regard. So that may not be an omission, but it's at least not directly parallel. And this is probably our most important objection to the bill in its current form. Section 5 mandates a report, and Mr. DeLashmut has indicated that that's a significant part of this legislation, to have a system for tracking assaults that occur in these facilities and programs. And employers are required to provide an annual report of assaults. But the system that's been set up for law enforcement reports doesn't include the employer. And so employers are required to report, but it's not clear to us how an employer or a hospital gets the law enforcement report in order to make the report that's required under the bill. So it seems like there's a system that needs to be refined in order to make the process actually work. One approach is to require that the reports go to the employer. The bill doesn't require that because it's requiring law enforcement reports. So there's an imbalance, at least, in the reporting requirements and how that should operate. And finally, it reads to me as in Section 7, Subsection 3, where there's provision about self-defense and authorized self-defense, that the provision as drafted may be overly broad and may allow a nurse to use physical force even if it's not an appropriate level of self-defense. And I think it's just a technical issue that might need to be narrowed to make the bill appropriate. Those are the kinds of objections that we still have with the bill. We do not condone nurse violence, and hospitals are committed to making hospitals as safe as possible for patients, staff, and the community in general. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bishop. Mr. Fiske.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Dave Fisk. I'm here representing Providence Health System, which, as you know, includes hospitals in several Oregon communities, Portland, Medford, Newburgh, Hood River, Seaside, Milwaukee. We took your chair's instructions seriously and had held several hallway and or meeting room negotiations with the Oregon Nurses Association, and I'm sorry to say today, to no avail, in the sense that we still are in disagreement. At the last meeting, it was an ONA representative who suggested that he thought we were still in fundamental disagreement, and I submit to you today that that is true. For Providence Health System, the guts of our concern, without repeating all of the points Mr. Bishop made, relates to the police reporting issue and the requirement of a police report and all of the associated language issues that Mr. Bishop pointed out. One of the things that we did spend a couple hours, maybe, or as many as 2 hours at the first negotiating session talking about was the existing OSHA reports, which are admittedly for a different purpose relative to time loss at work, but could be tweaked to allow for such a report if the objective is really to gather data, and I take the ONA at its word that it is. I would add, just as a general proposition, that one thing I've found, my client has found missing in this whole bill is the reason for which the data is gathered. Data gathering is fine. The presumption we have is both sides, ONA, hospital administration, and by the way, Mr. Chair, nurse executives could have been here today to talk to you about this bill, and we wanted to talk to you in this way, knowing your time frame. Both sides care deeply about the safety of nurses, and along the way, a charge has been made, privately, fortunately, that hospitals might be hospital administrators. We're tolerating a culture of abuse. I find that troubling. I don't find it to be true of my own experience, and I think we would be very willing to sit down with the ONA or any other nurse representatives at any moment, at any time. We'd be the first to the table to talk about what to do better than we now do, assuming we both have a commitment to safety of nurses. Mr. Glassman is right in his attempt to, Mr. Chair, follow one of the things you said to us in our first work group, which was to try to draw in language a distinction between, whatever the word is, regular patients and those involved with mental or psychiatric kinds of conditions. And I think the language in Section 2, Sub 10, demonstrates the great difficulty of actually drafting that to achieve the objective, and there was a good faith attempt to do so. That still is troubling to my client. They recognize why the language is there. They would applaud the attempt to do that, but still, in the end, it's going to come down to a judgment call on the ward by a combination of those who manage a ward and those who treat patients on that ward as to when reports are made. And by the way, at this moment, nothing prevents a police report from being made, and in fact, police reports are made when an assault occurs. That's probably, I think, without repeating all of Mr. Bishop's comments, our concerns. We still don't think a bill is necessary. We're pleased to work on the issue in a collaborative environment if one could be found. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll pause and be available at your discretion to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Biskin. Ms. Reeder, I know you have a specific concern, so please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Sarah Reeder. I am the executive director and lobbyist for the Oregon Association for Home Care. As I presented testimony to this committee previously regarding our concerns with the bill and its target of home health agencies, in particular among the home care providers delivering nursing care services to patients in their homes, we, at the request of our more than 60 home health agencies in the state, requested an amendment to remove home health agencies completely from the purview of this bill. As was presented by ONA testimony at the first hearing, there was merely only anecdotal information as it pertained to home health service delivery. And from basically what we could ascertain from that information that was presented, that the particular scenarios were more applicable to county public health independently contracted nurses than they were to nursing services being provided by a licensed home health agency. The other point I would like to make about that in terms of the target of one particular provider within a home, the home care industry, is that there are more than 100 in-home care agencies currently licensed in this state, and that number is growing very rapidly, as well as 45 certified and accredited hospices in the state. Both are other entities at which provide home care services in patients' homes that are not included in this bill. Now, I believe that the Dash 7 amendments address a change in Section 1, subsection, 7, sub C, that says a public or private entity that provides community or public health nursing services, but I still do not believe, understand what that means, number one, or that it would further address the other providers within the industry that are of concern to us. We know from surveying our members that the cost to deliver home care services in rural Oregon is 12 to 15% higher than in urban areas. To that end, Congressman Greg Walden has introduced legislation on our behalf to assist rural home health agencies in surviving and continuing to provide services and access to our patients in rural areas, such as Fossil, Oregon, La Grande, Oregon, Pendleton, Baker City. We continue to lose agencies. Since 1997, we've lost more than 32 home health care agencies. And with the additional regulations that this imposes with respect to an additional reporting requirement, whereby, as Mr. Fiskum and others have testified, we already have mechanisms in place through OSHA and other accrediting bodies that would provide the same information, as well as state statutes that address assaults and that do not preclude anyone from filing an assault report, we do feel that this is onerous and burdensome, again, on one specific provider type, and sets up a very unbalanced playing field with respect to its application. We, as I said, requested the Dash 1 amendments, and unfortunately, looking through those, I think that they only partially address the removal of home health agencies and do not address Section 9, which addresses home health care services. So I think that Legislative Council only partially removed the references to home health, and I'm not sure that that completely meets the needs that we had originally requested. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but again, those are the extent of my comments.
Thank you. What I'm going to do, because I've only got about 5 minutes before we'll be taking action on this bill, I'm going to ask Mr. Marvin Fickle and Bob Junedep to come forward.
Mr. Chair, could I try your patience for 10 seconds? And just for the record, I forgot to mention our concerns with Section 10 in the bill, which is the penalties section.
Yes.
And I won't belabor the point, but it strikes us as being a very aggressive penalty section for a brand new regime. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will depart.
Thank you. We only have a few minutes, gentlemen, so I would appreciate your comments that might be germane to things we haven't heard, or you know, if you want to just say amen to other comments, that would be fine. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedep. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center, and we advocate on behalf of folks with disabilities, and so I bring a perspective that is a little bit different than what you've heard today, and that is from perhaps the patient perspective. Our concern is primarily with folks who lay within our core constituency, and those folks with mental illness, developmental disabilities, brain injury, and other severe disabilities. What we're concerned about is not that there are abusive nurses out there, or not that facilities aren't safe, but what we're concerned about is that the solution to a perceived problem may go overboard and, in fact, turn the tables on the protection of patient safety. Section 2 of the bill is primarily designed, as I read it, as a protective services bill, which places nurses in the position of vulnerable populations. We think that should be reconsidered. And other various details of the bill, I would say, can be problematic in terms of the privacy of medical records, in terms of the right of an individual in their own home to be secure in their papers and in environment. So these are things that need to be considered further. My testimony covers particular points. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Junedep. My question for you, as this bill moves through the process, would you be willing to be engaged in further discussions on refining some of those elements?
Yes, of course, Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Hi. Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, my name's Marvin Fickle. I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital. I'm here again to testify in opposition to the amendments and the bill as it's currently written. I was hoping that the Oregon State Police would be providing testimony today regarding that section of the bill. Are they going to be available as far as we know?
They testified previously, and we're working with Representative Olson on that component. Okay. That is in the -7 amendment.
As Mr. Bishop and others have already alluded to, there are several sections of the bill which continue to be problematic for the state hospital, and I'll just focus on those two that are most problematic. The response of the police officer to a alleged reported assault can in fact produce a contrary kind of event, particularly if the officer does arrive on the unit with weapons of any sort. They're instructed under the bill to take actions necessary to restore and maintain order. We know obviously of situations in the recent past that have produced some rather dramatic incidents in local psychiatric facilities. Secondly, because of the large number of assaults which do occur regularly at the Oregon State Hospital, much to my chagrin and the horror of our nursing staff, I have great concerns on the impact of the ability of the Oregon State Police to, in fact, carry out the mandate of the bill and to do so in a timely fashion. Finally, in terms of the fiscal impact on the state hospital, it is difficult to ascertain, given the kind of outline that the bill makes with regards, or the amendments make with regards to how a nurse may decline to provide service. If, in fact, in a psychiatric environment, it moves to a situation where the nurse can refuse to provide treatment, it may require the patient and or the nurse to be moved to a different unit. This is a situation very dissimilar to that of a acute care surge, med-surge type hospital. That our fiscal people in Department of Human Services have stated that this could create a fiscal impact upwards of $3 million or more in the next fiscal cycle, which has not been represented in the governor's budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fickle, by the way, have you seen the dash? Have you read the -7?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Where the dental condition was actually a report to the employer as opposed to the law enforcement. I mean, have you read that section?
Chairman Metzger, I'm not exactly sure which part you're referring to. Because
On section, it's on page 3 of the -7, starting with line 29, nursing staff member, reasonable cause believe that a hospital patient or home health service patient with whom the nursing staff member comes into contact has assaulted a nursing staff member in a hospital or in the home of a home health services patient, and that the mental condition of the patient at the time of the assault limited the ability of the patient to understand the action, shall report the assault or cause a report to be made to the nursing staff employer in lieu of law enforcement agency. And I, if that partially is to address your issue.
Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, I certainly appreciate the ONA's attempts to address that issue for us, which is clearly an important one in the state hospital environment. Unfortunately, our numbers are still so very large that it's unlikely to impact very greatly the actual impact on the state police or our reference to those assaults.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Folks, it is the chair's desire to move this bill forward. I will say one thing here. First of all, I appreciate all the work that Mr. Bishop has done, Mr. Fiskum, in contributing. We've made a lot of modifications. I will tell you, and I appreciate some additional comments that were made. I think some of the technical applicability that Mr. Bishop particularly pointed out still needs to be refined. And one thing that I am assured of, that you will continue to participate in that process on the House side, I will continue to work aggressively with Representative Olson, the other chief sponsor on the House side, to continue to address the issues that I have now noted additionally today. But I think it is, I think it's an important policy that we set forward with a very, very important population. We've had the statistics earlier about how much higher these assaults are than for other professions. And I think to get a handle on this, this is a good step to do that. We've tried to address a lot of the issues in the -7s. It is still a work in process, but I think the bill is prepared to be moved at this time. And with that, I will close public hearing on Senate Bill 572. Open a work session on Senate Bill
572.
Senator Starr has moved that ask seven amendments to Senate Bill 572. Discussion on the amendment.
Yes.
Yes, Senator Monastir.
You know, the safety of nurses is so important, but I'm glad that we had one person testifying on the patient's safety and the confidentiality. And so I'm hoping that I don't feel that this bill is in good form for legislation, but I'm hoping that those changes will be made on the other side, because we have to look at the patient and their confidentiality as well as their condition of why they're being seen or their mental status.
Very good point. Thank you, Senator. Senator Atkinson.
I don't think I need to, but just to be on the safe side, I need to declare a potential conflict of interest. My wife serves on a nursing board in Southern Oregon. I also like to say that I came in here as a yes today, and I also believe that the home health care professionals were, I thought that was taken care of in the dash sevens. I will be undecided at this point on the floor. I'll be a no here just on the policy of I like to do things right. And I know that's not an accusation on the committee. It's just I know we're running out of session days, but I'll be a no today on just on that. But reserve judgment on the floor. I think this is an important issue, especially as my wife works with nurses. And,
right.
But I just don't. I think we're almost there. We're just not there yet.
Thank you, Senator Atkins. Rick Collins.
Mr.
Decker.
I thought the home health care thing is actually, I think it also is a legitimate issue. I don't know where it went in the whole negotiations, or so I'm not going to vote no, but I was hoping that would get at least solved, or there would be some amendment that at least was considered on that. And so I would only ask the group that I'll vote yes and then hope that at least that's given full consideration, because it seemed legitimate to me that really was a different from all the testimony we received at the original hearing. I didn't hear anything about home health care, and that just seemed like a different environment to me.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, just to comment on that, I would tend to agree. I've done both home health as well as the county. But I've actually had to call the police to go on visits with me on several occasions, especially when I was working in Portland. But I think there'll always be a risk in home health too. But I do understand Ms. Reeder's concerns. But I still think that the safety of nurses needs to be there also. So in a sense, I'm saying I'm not sure we should exclude home health. I think there needs to be more information brought forward from those agencies.
Thank you, sir. Objections to the dash 7 amendments? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Starr.
Would you entertain a discussion on the dash ones, or have we just had that?
Further discussion on the dash one. Well, they're not consistent with anything else.
They're not.
I don't mind having a discussion. We will not be moving the bill.
No,
okay. Not at this point.
Mr. Chair, then I would move the Senate Bill 532 as amended by the dash 7 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 572 as amended with the dash 7 amendments with a due pass recommendation. Discussion by the committee.
Mr. Chair, it'll echo, I think, the sentiment that there's obviously more work that needs to be done in this bill, and I'd expect that work to be done in the House. I'm one that would rather move complete pieces of legislation, but I understand the time restraints and conditions we're under. So I'll support the bill here, and I'll support it on the Senate floor.
Thank you, Senator. And I will tell all the people who have been working on this bill diligently, you've heard what the committee has said, and we've had many discussions on this as well. There is still some things to be done on this. I think it's proper to get that process moving, and we will be walking on that, and I know Representative Olson will be working diligently on these issues as we present them to him on the House side. They're still yet to be resolved. And keeping in mind that this bill will be coming back to us, because it will be revised, I know, in the House, for concurrence, and we expect that the critical issues that have yet to be resolved will be resolved before the bill becomes law. So that is this committee's pledge. And with that, objections to the motion? Senator Atkinson. Any others? Senate Bill 572 as amended will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll carry that, and we are out of time. We're adjourned.